Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. I'm Chris Benda, Theological Librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with Ellen Armour, E. Rhodes and Leona B. Carpenter Chair in Feminist Theology and Director of the Carpenter Program in Religion, Gender, and Sexuality, about her recent book, Signs and Wonders, Theology After Modernity. Ellen, thanks for being willing to take part in the interview.
Sure, I'm glad to do it.
I'd like to start with the subtitle of the book. So what circumstances have brought you to write about theology after modernity, and how do you understand those three terms?
That's a good question. I'll start with kind of how I understand the three terms. I think that will help get to that. You know, theology really means, basically, if you parse it out, reflection on, or reasoned reflection, really, on God or on the things of God, something like that, on religion and faith. And we've had a certain way of thinking about what that means in modernity. Modernity has been characterized often as in terms of a split, really, between the religious, a displacement almost of the religious, a displacement of God, in favor of the secular realm, in favor of reason, et cetera, et cetera. And what comes with that often is a kind of assignation of religion, and thus of theology, to the sphere of the private, or the sphere of, if not quite the irrational, certainly the irrational, in favor of, say, science or something along those lines. And that's kind of a dominant narrative of the place of theology or reasoned reflection about the things of God, if you will, in modernity. Then there's a different one. It's a scholarly one that's a little bit more refined, I guess, or confined maybe to the spheres of theory that I trade in a good bit. And that one would say that modernity itself is coming to an end. And in that one, the idea of modernity coming to an end is partly rooted in a conviction that maybe we're seeing the end of reason as the dominant way we understand the world. And the end of reason means perhaps making way for the return of religion, the return of faith, the return of theology, maybe, in a way that as long as reason was dominant, theology couldn't kind of play a role. That's at odds in some ways with some other ways of thinking about modernity, but you can hear that distinction, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you would think, as a theologian, I'd be all about the second way of reading, right? It's like, yes, finally, we get to return to our place of prominence as the queen of the sciences. Woohoo! I'm not that sanguine about that particular way of understanding the relationship between theology and modernity, or religion and modernity, for that matter.
Hmm.
So what I wanted to do, what I do with this book, is kind of complicate both of those narratives of what religion is, first of all, and of what theology is. First of all, I complicate the idea that theology is something that's really easily separable from culture, whether that's the modern culture or pre-modern culture, whether that's the culture of North America, the United States, or the culture of, Africa, or, someplace else, wherever there is religion, which is pretty much still everywhere. Reasoned reflection about that goes on all the time, and it's deeply informed by its culture, whatever that culture happens to be. So I say in the introduction somewhere, I think, that I don't really know where culture begins and theology ends, if you will, or the vice versa. And part of that is because of the history of Christianity and the West, especially the history of Christianity in the U.S. We're not living under a Christian emperor like we would have been if in the Constantinian period, for example. But I think there are still residue of Christendom. And so one thing that's true of our time is, even though most people aren't terribly literate in Christian theology, they are, whether they know it or not, literate in a sense in some of the tropes and some of the figures that are deeply Christian. And those are out there and available for folks to pick up and use in a variety of ways. So that's kind of how I'm understanding the relationship, I guess, with theology's presence in our time and place is part of it. But I'm also doing it as a constructive theologian. This project is, I'm undertaking that as a constructive theologian. I want to lift up and pay attention to how theology is manifesting in this, in our day and age, in these ways, so that we can think critically about it, and so that we can think and anticipate what we might want to see happen, what I think in any way needs to happen as we approach what I do think will be the end of modernity. But that's another long disquisition to talk about that.
Right. Yeah. You talk about the word after.
Yeah.
So what valence does after have?
Well, academics can be very sly about these things. So after might sound like I'm suggesting that modernity is over, right? Mm-hmm. So we are after modernity. But I'm, again, not terribly sanguine about that either. I talk about after as more in the sense of following after, that there is a sense in which we can look at modernity in our rearview mirror in a way, right? And I'm proposing a way we look at modernity in our rearview mirror. The fact that we can do that suggests that we are in some way, you know, beyond it, perhaps. But the way in which we're beyond it, if we are, is really still very much shaped by, right, what modernity gave birth to and what we are now struggling to live under the disintegration of, if you will, is the way that I see it. So we're not, there's no clean break, as I see it, between modernity and where we are. That's another way in which I'm kind of troubling, I guess, this notion of what it might mean to be beyond modernity, to be postmodern, to be after modernity. And you could also say, I don't think I say this in the book, but you could also say that what this book does is in some ways kind of try to, I mean, it's almost like a dog with a bone, right? I'm trying to chase after this residual form of modernity and what gave rise to it and what its impact is now, and even as we're living under the disintegration of much of what modernity has wrought.
Interesting image.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I have a dog, so that might be why it kind of comes to mind pretty quickly.
Right. Much of the book focuses on close analyses of four recent events. Mm-hmm. The consecration of Gene Robinson as the first openly gay Episcopalian bishop.
Right.
The abuse of prisoners at Abu Ghraib prison. The political firestorm surrounding Terri Schiavo and whether she should live or die. Mm-hmm. And Hurricane Katrina. Mm-hmm. How did you settle on these particular signs and wonders?
It was a long and in some ways organic process. I came to the insight about the kind of basic framework of the book, which we'll talk about later, I'm sure, much earlier, actually in probably around 2000 even. But didn't really... That, I wasn't thinking that was going to be a book project at the time. I was just thinking, I think this is something I need to think through and think with. And then Abu Ghraib happened. And I felt I had to say something about that. I had to do something about that insofar as I was able. So actually what became the nexus of that chapter, the chapter is much different now than it was when I first gave a paper about it and had an essay published about it, was really an attempt to do that. And it was very clear to me that framework that I had come to was clearly at issue with Abu Ghraib. And then, you know, similar things. I just kind of felt like compelled in some way to respond to these different events that had happened. And with each one, I could see the valence, I suppose, that that this framework that I had come up with offered as a way into what was going on and really the deeper issues. And that's the thing. To me, these events are all singular and all distinct in some ways. And yet they all, I think, open up and on to more serious ongoing challenges that we confront now. Mm-hmm. And they each do so in a different way. And so it's as much because of the differences between them as it is the similarities, that mm-hmm. kind of underlying similarities that led me to talk about them and to put them together mm-hmm. in this particular project.
We'll go a little bit more into the specifics of the events, although mm-hmm. I'm going to leave the reader, the listener, okay. to do some reading.
Okay, good.
But before we get there, I wanted to ask about your conception of that you use throughout the book of the fourfold mm-hmm. of man, his divine other, mm-hmm. his animal other, and his raced and sexed others. Mm-hmm. And you read these events in terms of this fourfold. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you could talk about, you know, what led you to conceive mm-hmm. of this fourfold mm-hmm. and how you understand its various components interacting with mm-hmm. each other. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, mm-hmm. what makes the fourfold specifically modern?
Mm-hmm. Good question. What led me to it is really actually in some ways obscure to me at this point, which is very strange, because I came to it actually. The book concludes with, it concludes with a reading of a book of Jacques Derrida's, right, called Le Toucher. I actually came to the fourfold through working on that book and through a paper that I gave at the AAR a bunch of years ago in response to that book. It was before it had been translated. It was part of a big thing. You know, Derrida was there for several sessions. There were a whole host of sessions on his work. And I remember saying the first time I came to it through working on that paper for that. And I remember when I gave the paper saying, okay, I'm about to say something that's going to make me very nervous. I'm going to speak in these giant epochal terms, which really makes me nervous because I don't like that idea so much. But I wonder if we might think of modernity in terms of a fourfold of man and his others. And the term fourfold I get from the philosopher Martin Heidegger. Mm-hmm. It's not his fourfold. It's a different one. But I went on to say that getting that term from him, I'm suggesting, and as I talk about it in the book too, I think it's one of the reasons and values of thinking about it in terms of Heidegger's fourfold too, is that it is something that gives rise to something else, right? Mm-hmm. And it is something that we inhabit without thinking about it. His fourfold, it was understood. For him, though, it was a bit more nostalgic than mine. There's not a bit of nostalgia in what I'm working with here. But it gives rise to a whole system of thinking, a whole way of, as I say, knowing, being, and doing, really. Mm. So that's kind of how it started. And as I say, I could see connections, you know, when, like with the Abu Ghraib event, that seemed pretty obvious to me that there was a fourfold going on. The real twist happened in a couple of ways. I remember talking to a publisher, an editor at one point about, once I had the book project kind of conceived, and I went to this editor with it, and I said, you know, doesn't this looks, and he was like, yeah, this looks really interesting, and I think it'd be great, but we'd have to have the first chapter. And I was like, oh. Yeah, I guess you would. And so then I was stuck with, well, how do I make a case for this fourfold as modern, mm-hmm. right, without doing a whole history of modern theology and philosophy from Descartes forward?
Mm.
And I actually gave that a shot. Now, I mean, a very sketchy shot. It didn't work. It was really terrible. So I made a couple of stabs at that, and then I was like, okay, I just can't do it. I'm going to have to put that aside for a little bit and do something else. So the other insight I had come to as well was that that I really wanted, that photographs were important to this project, mm-hmm. which I know is also something we may want to talk about. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want to treat the photographs, to again stay in that Heideggerian framework for a moment, as something present to hand, as you know, just immediately available, mm-hmm. what they were and what they said, what they meant, etc. I wanted to pay attention to the medium, So I consulted with a friend of mine who's an art historian, and I asked, you know, where should I go to learn about, you know, the scholarship on photography? And so he gave me a few suggestions and places to go. And so I started doing all this reading in visual culture theory and history of photography and all that stuff. And lo and behold, my fourfold, my little tiny fourfold, was all over it.
Wow.
Absolutely all over it. I'm still just, it's just astonishing to me that that's the case. But it was all over the history of the establishment of, I mean, we take photographs for granted as presenting us with, you know, just that there then. Here's mm-hmm. what, you know, and their truth is straightforward. But it took a while for that truth to be established as straightforward, and my fourfold was all wrapped up in that, actually, and I trace a good bit of that in the chapter on photography. And that also led me to two of the books that were particularly important for me in that long apprenticeship of kind of trying to learn visual culture theory and history of photography, were books by Jonathan Cleary and John Tagg, who were Foucauldian, and they were kind of Foucauldian scholars, and so Foucauldian projects. And all of a sudden it came to me, that's how I could do the first chapter. That's how I could anchor this fourfold, make a case for it. Because, so the project took a decidedly Foucauldian turn, which in the world of continental philosophy is a really pretty dramatic shift. And it was for me, too. I mean, it's not that they're two opposing schools exactly, but they really are very different. And so to switch from, and I'd been a Derridian all of my intellectual life up to that point, to switch to Foucault as the anchoring figure was a big change. And again, a big change too, because though I'd been teaching Foucault for a long time and had certainly studied Foucault when I was in doing my PhD, I had never written anything on Foucault. So to get some credibility as a Foucault, you know, a Foucault scholar, so to speak, you know, that also took a while. I had to familiarize myself again with a new body of secondary literature and all that. So that was a big switch. Mm. But that helped immensely, because Foucault is not really, he's a philosopher, he's a cultural theorist, he's a historian of sorts. The historians would scream to hear me say that. But the particular way that he understands the work he does, in fact, he describes his own body of work as, in some ways, a history of, or an attempt at a history of the present, at a history of how we became who we are, an investigation, an inquiry into really, you know, the invention of modern subjectivity, I guess, and its consolidation and all of what has been wrought through that. So I ended up saying and arguing in that first chapter that this fourfold is actually a channel of what Foucault calls, or to put them together, biopower and disciplinary power, two forms of power that are unique to modernity, and that they... I can talk about what makes these two forms of power different.
Sure. That would help. Yeah, I think that would be useful.
So we tend to think of power as domination, right? Mm-hmm. Power over. That kind of power is more, and that's certainly an important form of power. That form of power has been with us human beings for quite a long time, and it is closer to what Foucault would call sovereign power. And sovereign power has been with us for a very, very long time. If sovereign power has its roots in, let's say, ancient Rome, for example, where the Roman concept of patria potestas, which is the absolute power of the Roman father, the patriarch, from where we get that term, of the Roman family, of life or death, over all of those in his household. And that is also the power of the sovereign, or was the power of the sovereign in the ancient world. It's the power to kill, right? And Foucault opens what is probably the most important of his books on disciplinary power, Discipline and Punish, A History of the Prison, with a description of the drawing and quartering of a regicide, a guy who was trying to kill the king, and asks the question, what is it about this particular form of killing that has to be done, right? It's spectacular. it's drawn out. It's not, you know, if all that was needed was simply to kill the guy, that could be done right. with great dispatch and very quickly. But no, the spectacle is important to help people see, remind them that they are part of the sovereign's body. This mm-hmm. is still a body politic, right? But let's make no mistake about who is actually control and who is actually in control and who controls living and dying, mm. right? And it's the power to kill that makes that possible. In modernity, things change a bit. Sovereign power is still there, but it is exercised in a subordinate, really, to disciplinary power and biopower. And those forms of power, too, are different in the way that they work. If sovereign power seems very much power over, right? Mm-hmm. Disciplinary power and biopower are more diffuse kind of networks of power. Disciplinary power targets the body, basically the individual body, and seeks to create docile bodies, Foucault says, right? And disciplinary power does it through what we might call a combination of carrots and sticks. Think about the schoolroom. Hmm. Think about the factory. Think about the prison, right? Any of those places, which are attempts, you know, the prison, we could say, is certainly, for all of its problems, probably a more humane thing than simply than drawing and quartering, hmm. maybe. And particularly the prison as it was originally envisioned, and sometimes still works this way, but often not, as a reformatory, hmm. right? So we isolate people, we put them under surveillance, we give them various incentives too, a very disciplined, regimented form way of living, right, for a while, that encourages self-reflection. Mm-hmm. We ask them to reflect on themselves. It's all done under the watchful eye of God, right? In the old prisons, you used to see signs, God is watching you everywhere, right? You confess, and the whole thing is to bring you to a point of acknowledging that the root of your behavior was actually in who you are, that you are a delinquent at heart, and you would like to be something other than delinquent. You would like to reform that mm-hmm. and be able to reenter society as a productive, docile, you know, law-abiding citizen, right? So you hear discipline then working in that system. But the same thing's true in the school system, right? Mm-hmm. What do we have to learn in order to succeed? To sit at our desks, to raise our hands, to be quiet, to work for, you know, at least 15 minutes at a time, you know, all mm. that. So as much of what's going on in the school system, too, is teaching us, is socializing us, mm. disciplining us, teaching us to accommodate ourselves to a particular form of discipline. And if we do that, we succeed, mm. right? I mean, I'm a prime example of it. I figured out how to do that. I submitted myself to that discipline, you know, better than a lot of other people, right? So, and here I am doing it again, right? Part of that
reproducing
that very system. Well, again, on students who have, you know, largely right. succeeded, or they wouldn't be right. in graduate school, right?
Right.
Yeah, so that's another form of disciplinary power. So that's disciplinary power. Biopower. If sovereign power was a power to kill, biopower is a power to let live or allow to die, mm. as Foucault describes it. And biopower's target, if disciplinary power's target is the individual body, biopower's target is the population. It exercises its power in a desire to make the race live. It's really trying to, you know, help the human race survive and thrive, mm-hmm. right? I describe biopower as both positively and negatively racist, because it's positively racist in that it wants to see the race, mm-hmm. right, the human race survive. It's negatively racist in that, and the way it does that is by going after abnormality, mm. right? So it invents these things called norms and you know, all the various things like urban planning, like eugenics, you know, to think of a negative one, but public health, these kinds of concerns are all biopower making itself manifest, right? So it all designed to eradicate abnormality. Mm. Abnormality has this uncanny way of showing up in certain populations, mm. right? Descendants of slaves, for example, immigrant populations, you know, and so on. It certainly shows up everywhere, but it shows up with particularly higher rates, mm. supposedly, in these places, right? And again, you can think of all kinds of examples of studies that you know, we would want to distance ourselves from, but nonetheless, that have exhibited that kind of understanding. And so those particular populations are subject to biopower is more violent and virulent effects, we could say, right? Mm-hmm. The Tuskegee study, syphilis study, for example, would be one. The fact that actually now, and, you know, one of the things, I just heard a story just recently on NPR, I think, noticing that all of a sudden, in the last few years, white people's life expectancy has shortened, and black people's life expectancy has actually lengthened over a long period of time. Mm-hmm. There's still a gap, but still a discrepancy, but, you know, and they're tracing that to, you know, it is a matter of certain kinds of privilege and certain kinds of access to health care and all that sort of stuff. There's a rural-urban split now, so now that the rural poor, who, you know, are often white, are experiencing some of the deprivations that, you know, black people experience for a long, long time. So these are examples of, you know, the ways in which we, you know, biopower works. So it allows it, and usually we would say allows to die, because it's not that it is actively killing people most of the time, but by the way that it distributes goods and services, like medical goods and services, is going to have an effect on who lives and who dies, and how the manner of that living and dying. So in that sense, actively racist too, right? Does that make sense? I feel like I've gotten a long way from your original question.
Well, I wonder if you could I mean, this is all very helpful. If you could sketch just briefly what the fourfold actually is. I mean, you know, what do the various four elements mean?
Well, I'll try that.
Okay.
So, again, the
listener will have to go to the book.
That's
the
to
details.
Really understand it. Yeah, that's definitely true. So if, by talking about this fourfold as a channel of biodisciplinary power, one of the crucial elements, the crucial element, I think probably the really most crucial element in the fourfold is probably that one between man and his divine other. But they're all connected to each other. But, and why I say that's the most crucial is, remember we talked about modernity this when we first started our conversation, about one story of the emergence of modernity as a displacement of religion and a displacement of God, really. What I show is going on in Foucault's work is a description of an account of how that displacement happened, really, right? And it's, and that displacement is first and foremost of God as the knower, right? And the one who sets up the conditions of knowing anything, right? And that in modernity, this is one of the effects of modernity, I guess, is the creation is the creation of man as the one who knows and the one who determines the conditions of knowing too. Now the odd thing is man is also subject to knowing, right? In fact, subject to being known by his own methods of, you know, of knowing. So you'd have to say that man displaces God, but doesn't replace God, because God, the man can't know in the way that God was supposed to have known, right? Not everything and everything. And also man displaces God as the putative master over life and death. That's also what happens in biopower, right? And so what you see then is, and that's one of the places where, well, there are at least two places where the other elements of the fourfold come in, right? To demonstrate his mastery over knowing and over life and death too requires, is in part bound up with demonstrating mastery over his others, right? Race and sexed others, his animal other too, right? And yet there are things he shares in common with these others too. So the borderline between, I keep referring to the fourfold as a hall of mirrors, that the kind of border between man and his others, the borders between them, is a permeable one. And part of what happens in modernity are attempts to kind of both set up those borders. We can trace that too with the history of race and the history of homosexuality, especially the history of sexuality and history of race are endemic to, central to that, and gender is bound up with that too. To setting up those boundaries and trying to maintain those boundaries at all costs, it seems like, at all costs. And yet, because those boundaries are permeable, there's this ongoing, permanent, really, you might say, state of anxiety about those borders too, which sets up than man's mastery as both a projection and a project, right? And thus modern subjectivity as both a projection and a project. That is, and tracing the labor that's involved in that project is part of what happens too in these chapters as well.
Yeah. You had already mentioned using photographs.
Yeah.
And I wondered how you came to the realization that you really needed to bring photographs into your project.
Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, it's particularly true, I guess, with the Abu Ghraib photographs, but really for all of those events, with the possible exception of Gene Robinson's consecration, with all of those events, and I say pause, I'll explain that in a second, all of those events came to us, their impact on us as a wider culture, it was predominantly through photographs, and certainly with the case of Abu Ghraib, that was a scandal all about photographs,
right,
to begin with, right? But certainly the way that they were taken up, those photographs were taken up, and what they led to or didn't, as the case may be, you think of that, they were central to it. Same for Terri Schiavo. The reason we know about her at all was through, mostly it was a video but very few of us saw the video. Most of us saw just stills from that video, but they were very powerful in terms of what they communicated in some way to us, the way they motivated people. And the same for Hurricane Katrina. Most of us observed Hurricane Katrina. I mean, FEMA couldn't get there, but somehow TV crews could. And, you know, journalists could.
Yeah.
And so most of us were observing what was going on there on our TV screens and through newspaper photographs, et cetera, all the time. And in Gene Robinson's case, that too, you know, how many consecrations of bishops? It's just a bishop. It's not even an archbishop. How many consecrations of bishops have there been all over the world and, you know, since the inception of the Church of England? But I'm betting that this is probably the only one that's made the front page of the New York Times with a photograph and with a second photograph embedded. Now, that's a newspaper's decision, print newspaper, to devote that much space to the story of a consecration is huge. That's just huge. And again, that means for a lot of people, most people weren't there for the consecration, right? But a lot of people encountered that event through the newspaper or through, you know, television accounts of it, whatever it happened to be. And that's endemic of our time and place too, right? That photographs carry that kind of power, and it's even more true now, I think, with social media and so on, that, you know, that visual imagery really is so central to how we communicate and so on. So that was how I came to it originally, was that these photographs were so central to what happened and to their impact on us. And then that require then having to ask the question of, well, how do photographs impact on us, actually? You know, how do they work? How are they working in these particular situations, too? And trying to be, you know, fairly specific about that. And that does require some care, I think, in terms of understanding them. One text that was particularly helpful to me is a book by two communications scholars, on iconic photographs. So that notion of iconicity is really interesting to a theologian, to be sure, right? This is a term with religious provenance, theological provenance, in fact, right? That supposedly they open up something, right? Open up onto something bigger than themselves. And their study of iconic photographs, which is aptly called No Caption Needed, right? It's perfect. One of the things, the central claim that they make is that photographs are circuits of political affect that that engage people in that sort of, that compel people in, to some extent, to respond to them affectively, right? And sometimes then politically, right? This is what makes an iconic photograph iconic. So they're the kind of iconic example, if you will, is a photograph from the Depression era called Migrant Mother, which you've probably seen, of a woman very haggard looking, you know, holding her child in her arms and looking off into the distance with seemingly hopelessly.
Yeah.
That was a photograph, a professionally produced photograph, by a woman whose name I can't think of right off the top of my head, a very famous photographer. It'll come to me at some point. Who was working for the Works Progress Administration, and a lot of it was aimed at and was used to actually cultivate support for the New Deal. Mm-hmm. And it worked. You know, it largely worked. And think about that photograph, too, when we think about iconic, right? It's the, when we talk about it as iconic, part of what makes it work, it's an example of what I was talking about earlier about theology as a kind of cultural, a form of cultural capital. It resembles the Pietà, right? And that's part of what makes it so impactful, I think, and makes it move people, quite literally, right, to do things. It's the same with the Abu Ghraib photographs. A lot of us were moved to protest, right, by those photographs. Others of us, I mean, that moved me to write a paper, but a big, yeah, that helped a lot. But, you know, but did move people to protest. It moved a lot of artists to make protest art. And that as a way of mobilizing people to further protest what was being done in our name. It moved other people to create pornography based on some of the, you know, some of those images. And it certainly likely moved other people to join the terrorist forces, right? Because of seeing what Americans had done to their comrades. So
a variety of
things. Yeah. That's right. That's right. So so when and I think that's one thing I try to highlight that I'm not sure Lucchetti's and Harriman did as much is the that, you know, there's no one way that photographs move us. They move us in a variety of ways. But that's a really important dimension to them, I think. And that's something that's distinctive about them as opposed to, say, simply a simple textual analysis wouldn't really be able to get at that component of the political effects of photographs, for good and for ill, if you will.
Right.
Yeah.
Wasn't Dorothy Lange?
That's it.
Okay.
Dorothy Lange. That's exactly who it is.
Good.
Yep, that's
I was
exactly
thinking
who it is.
We need to think.
Yes, that's exactly who it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Oh, it's such fun being middle-aged.
That's right.
Yeah.
So as I said multiple times, you know, listeners are going to actually have to read your book to get the details on what we're talking about. But one thing that I wanted to ask about was a theme that runs through the book and that you discuss in more detail towards the end of the book, which is vulnerability.
Yeah.
And you write, quote, biodisciplinary power, the power you were talking about earlier, this combination of biopower and disciplinary power. Biodisciplinary power and its fourfold has successfully, which is not to say totally, colonize the visual in the service of its drive toward mastery over self, over others, over nature, over life, and over death. That drive for mastery is rooted in the disavowal of vulnerability, unquote. And then you suggest that, quote, whatever else we need from a new philosophy of life, we need it to enable us to face up to the very vulnerability that biodisciplinary power seeks to disavow, unquote. So in what ways do you see us individually and collectively being able to take on vulnerability?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll start with a very kind of straightforward way, and this is kind of, you know, again, we're going to have Heidegger coming back up a little bit. You remember I said that man displaced God as the master over life and death, and mastery was really the attempt to, you know, achieve that. Heidegger, I don't think I put it this way quite in the book, but Heidegger is particularly known for talking about the human being as being towards death, right? That one thing that is true of us is that we will all die. The other thing that's true of us is that we know we will die. Mm-hmm. That's another thing. But we really try not to know that we're going to die. Mm-hmm. And we do pretty much everything we can not to have to think about that or face up to that or confront that. And that is really a central element of our vulnerability. So the Terri Schiavo case, I think, is a particularly a case in point, right? That whole political firestorm was about whether she should be allowed to die, if that was one way of putting it, or whether she was being killed in some way. Mm. And a lot of the controversy, you know, it moved, that controversy moved people to do all kinds of things, to make living wills, for example, that would try to specify that, yes, if I were to be in that kind of circumstance, I would not want to continue to live. On the other hand, a lot of disability activists were very disturbed by this push to quote unquote allow her to die, partly because all it was going to be involved was the removal of a feeding tube. She wasn't being kept alive by any quote unquote extraordinary means, really. It was just the removal of a feeding tube, and there are a lot of people with disabilities who are dependent on a feeding tube. So it's kind of like, okay, you know, right. What kind of decision are we making? And we're making the decision for her. You know, she's not making the decision. So, again, you see this whole emphasis on sovereignty, self-sovereignty, right, as the way that it should go. And that's the way that biomedicine, in some ways, tries to deal with it. Okay, well, we're going to put all the power on you to decide, you know, we, in our seeking of a good death, you know, when are you ready to pull the plug, so to speak, right? Well, that depends on having somebody who's fully conscious and aware. And all of biomedicine is really aimed at putting death off as long as possible, right? And sometimes we put ourselves through a whole lot of suffering in the attempt to put off death as long as possible. So that's one form of vulnerability, and it's a major one that motivates biopower and biodisciplinary power, really, you know, the move to allow the race to flourish and to thrive and so on. It means extending the lifespan of as many, you know, certain people, at least,
right,
as possible.
The ones
right,
that right. make the cut.
That's right, the ones that make the cut. And then eliminating the ones that, you know, don't make the cut as part of what enables them to survive. So it's really crucial. It's a kind of engine driving it. And yet it drives it in part by encouraging us to disavow that death is going to be inevitable and that there are limits to our mastery, right? I mean, we still are, you know, good night, the whole debate over climate change too, right? You know, that just to get into another one that's pertinent to the chapter on Hurricane Katrina. So all these, all of these, the ways that we live in the world are deeply aimed at disavowing and masking our vulnerability. So, and I think I hope this is the way that the book reads, but my intent in organizing the chapters the way that I did is that our awareness of that vulnerability and of our inability, really, and you know, of mastery as really unachievable, would build as through each of those chapters. So to end with Hurricane Katrina, right,
yeah.
Where you know, which is, if anything, I call it, I think the title of that chapter, or subtitle, I forget, is the perfect storm.
Perfect storm.
In part because it's, you know, the very geography of especially New Orleans, but, you know, Louisiana, the bayous and all that, is an example of, you know, engineering, right? And our attempt to engineer ourselves into mastery over, you know, over climate, over the ocean, over everything, you know, in that. And that blew up in our faces, quite literally, right? And similarly, in terms of what happened at Memorial Medical Center, which, you know, where a bunch of people were essentially euthanized. And when I talk about that, too, you know, that was an example of our mastery just kind of really falling apart there, right? I mean, I'm not trying to pass judgment at all on the medical professionals who made the decision that that was the best way to handle what was a horrible circumstance. You know, I could easily see how they could come to that conclusion. And I don't want to minimize the suffering that they endured, too, in making that decision and carrying it out had to be pretty rough. But what brought us to, that's what is of interest to me, what brought them to and all of us to that situation where, you know, there's an utter breakdown of all the structures and of all the of everything that's supposed to, that has been built up to try to push that off. Well, we see it, and that's not going to get us very far anymore. So we need to figure out some way, at least my hope is, that if we start with we need a new philosophy of life. I mean by that a new ontology and a new ethos, that is, a new way of understanding being and a new way of living, right? That instead of placing us at the kind of top of a chain of being, so to speak, cuts differently across the lines that between different forms of being and between different individual instances of any particular form of being. And there are a lot of other folks saying that. I'm not alone in making that claim. But whatever that new philosophy of life needs to do, it needs to enable us to face up to that vulnerability, which is both finitude and also our deep interconnectedness, you know, to each other and to really everyone in the world in some ways, right? Mm-hmm. And to all the other forms of life and to the earth and to, you know, the universe, all that. And I'm not saying that as a kind of in a romantic way. It's just simply a fact of life. And I think that's another thing that you see running through all of these chapters is the depth of our interconnectedness too, you know, and we certainly see it with, you know, the global war on terror and the, you know, just and the events of 9/11, right? Mm-hmm. All of a sudden it's like, wow, I could take for granted that I can, you know, just wander around and all this violence I'm seeing will be someplace else. But no, I'm, you know, that isn't true. Mm-hmm. I'm dependent on a bunch of other people not doing stuff, if nothing else, right? For that to be the case. So I think that kind of, that recognition of vulnerability and of our deep interdependence on each other is really crucial to going forward, any way of going forward.
Because I have something of a background in biblical studies, the last question has to invoke the Bible in some way, but of course of course your text, the title of your book also invokes. Deuteronomy 26:8 says in the New Revised Standard Version, "The Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, with a terrifying display of power and with signs and wonders."
Yeah.
Your accounts of signs and wonders seem to be a good deal more ambivalent, even if they might eventuate in facing up to vulnerability. Mm-hmm. Again, because you're a theologian, I have to ask you about God. In the closing pages of Signs and Wonders, you express preference for what you call a planetary God, over a kind of deus ex machina. Mm-hmm. And the deus ex machina you characterize as a God who will, quote, who will swoop down from on high to rescue us from what will be, unquote. And then a planetary God, in contrast, quote, is an uncanny God caught up in and by the shifts and changes underway at any given time, as what is gives way to what will be. Mm-hmm. Unquote. Mm-hmm. So my question in juxtaposing these, can such a planetary God as you describe be a liberatory God? And if so, in what way? Or do we just need to rethink what we mean by what we might think of when we talk about liberation?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say yes, because if you think about, if liberation were going to be accomplished by divine fiat, it would have happened a long time ago. We wouldn't be living in the kind of world we're living in now. Mm-hmm. And it has, with the possible exception of Exodus, it hasn't happened that way. Mm-hmm. It's been, I'm thinking back to, you know, Obama was fond of quoting Martin Luther King, right, about the long arc of history bends toward justice. I think that's actually not a bad way to think about how liberation would figure into this, right? It is a long arc, and it bends. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't
dive.
It's not a direct route. It's not a direct route. That's right. It's not a direct route. And it depends utterly and deeply on us, really, right? And when I say utterly, I don't mean that's the only thing going on, but when we come together to work toward justice, toward liberation, and when we understand that as work that that is divinely sanctioned, right, that is the work of God, and we have good reason for saying that, right, even though we lose sight of that truth, I think, often. And that's certainly the history of Christianity, is it, you know, to go back to Christendom, you know, got aligned with empire and has stayed that way for a very long time. But when we retrieve that truth about what God wants in the world and align ourselves with that truth, and engage the practices that are going to bring it about, it's always a long slog. Hmm. It's always a slow slog. And it always requires that we work together. It requires the kind of cooperation, too, that I think I'm pointing toward. And it draws on, I think, the deep wisdom of our religious traditions. I mean, I'm talking about Christianity, but it certainly isn't only Christianity. Those roots are deeply Jewish roots, for one thing. Even the Christian roots of it are deeply Jewish. And other religious traditions also have that drive toward justice in some form or fashion as a major impetus in what they do too. So it is living out in some ways, right, and living into what we take to be the truth of what our religious traditions are about, and thus we are doing the will of God. We might say, right? We think we would say that's what we're doing. Now, how we understand God in that picture does, I think, have to be much more complicated. It's not the big, you know, man upstairs with the beard and, you know, leaning down and looking down at us and saying, "I told you not to do that. I told you to do this." It's something much more complex and much more diffuse, if you will, perhaps. And the notion of the planetary God I get mostly from Myra Rivera, from her work, where she's talking about that. But there are other versions of it. Process theology, I think, has a notion of God that's very much aligned with this one, which understands, and process might be a good example to use here. A lot of process theologians are deeply connected to and invested in liberation kinds of movements. And they would talk about divine power in a different way, right? It's not power over, it's not domination. Anybody can dominate in some ways, right? Think about, you know, a little kid playing with their toy soldiers, you know, can dominate them, make them do whatever they want. But the more impressive power is the power of persuasion, right? And that's the power that that process theologians would talk of as particularly distinctive to God. It can sound like a kind of weakness, in a sense, in that God can't make us choose to do any particular thing. We still very much have free will and the process understanding. But God is always trying to work with and through and with all of us toward you know, making the world a better place, toward the pursuit of justice and so on and so forth. That's one way of understanding it. So it's not Deus ex machina,
right?
Definitely not.
Right.
But it might be a God that at least I find a lot more appealing, and I think a lot of people do now, and that is very much in line with the God that's witnessed to in biblical tradition too, actually. But that's a topic for another day, probably. Yeah.
Well, maybe another book.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be that too. Yeah.
Thank you for this conversation.
Sure.
Great. Again, I've been talking with Ellen Armour, E. Rhodes and Leona B. Carpenter Chair in Feminist Theology and Director of the Carpenter Program in Religion, Gender, and Sexuality, about her recent book, Signs and Wonders, Theology After Modernity, published by Columbia University Press in the Gender, Theory, and Religion series. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.